Okay. First of all, before I introduce the two speakers, can I have a show of hands for anyone who doesn't know Andrew Gale's background? Okay. Oh, Angela. Yes. Andrew is the appointed actuary at Medibank Private and has been focusing on health insurance for at least a decade, maybe 15 years. And he runs the Private Health Insurance Subcommittee of the Health Practice Committee, and in that capacity, he and Peter Lurie have been working on professional guidance. Anyone not know Peter Lurie's background? Okay, everyone knows Peter. Oh, Peter is an actuary based in Perth and focusing on both health insurance and general insurance. And if you wind back 20 years ago, he used to work in Melbourne with a great company called National Mutual. They're going to talk about professional guidance, professional standards.
Thanks, Stuart. I think professional guidance is the collective term that covers all the Institute's guidance to its members, from professional standards through practice guidance and information notes. But is there a way to make this work? No, there we go. Okay, so in health insurance, we've actually been working on some guidance notes for a number of years, or a number of years ago we commenced putting in place some guidance notes for actuaries working in the health insurance field. So we have three guidance notes that I'm sure a number of you are familiar with. GN650, which is on actuarial reports and advice on outstanding claims in health insurance. GN660 for financial projections for health insurers, principally around rate increase submissions, and GN670 supporting the financial condition reports requirement for appointed actuaries. And something new, I suppose, in the Institute's guidance framework were information notes, and the Health Practice Committee did issue two of these last year, both really relating to the Medicare levy surcharge changes that occurred. Firstly, in relation to the measure that was being proposed, and then later in the year, in December, in relation to its impact, taking into account the changes on financial projections and rate submissions. So that's the guidance we've got in place, and really I'm going to talk about how we've got to where we are, and then Peter's going to start talking about how we intend to review these, and what we need to do to update the guidance we have in place for health insurance actuaries. The GN650 was the first one that we put in place in 1999, so it's coming up to 10 years old now, which actually surprised me when I first that first came to mind. I do remember those early days when the Health Practice Committee got together to put this guidance note in place. And it focused on outstanding claims, really built off some of the work that had been done by the general insurance actuaries to put in place something that was particular to the health insurance environment and captured some of the unique features of health insurance that is required when doing outstanding claims provisions. And importantly, it was put in place well before AASB 1023 started to apply to health insurers a few years ago, so it predates the application of that standard, and therefore there's a number of things that have occurred since that standard was introduced. GN660 was introduced in 2002, and it was really in response to the Department of Health and Ageing's requirement for the first time that health insurers' rate increase applications were needed to include an actuarial opinion on financial projections from January 2003. So it was in response to the Department of Health and Ageing introducing that requirement on health funds. It was decided that health insurance actuaries should be given some guidance on how to go about that. And the third one, financial condition reports, guidance note issued in July 2004, about the same time that the General Insurance Practice Committee issued a similar guidance note on financial condition reports in general insurance. Once again, as a response to activity from FIAC this time that introduced this requirement for health funds to have a financial condition report prepared by an actuary each year from the financial year 04-05 onwards. As I said before, it's, some of those now have got 10 years behind them, and I think they have served as well as a health insurance actuarial profession, but do need some updating. We've had the formal appointed actuary regime come in under the 2007 PHI Act. Of course, FIAC had their requirements predating that, but this really just was the first legislative formalisation of the appointed actuary role in April 2007. And with that comes the notifiable circumstances, responsibilities, the list of 8 or 10 things that constitute notifiable circumstances that the appointed actuary needs to be made aware of those events happening and being given the opportunity to provide actuarial advice. So that none of that is incorporated into our present set of guidance. As I said before, AASB 1023 now applies, and so there's a whole range of material in relation to risk margins and the liability adequacy tests that just are not covered in our guidance. And there's new general insurance guidance, which being, I suppose, the most similar practice area to our own, that is good material that we could take into account in furthering our own guidance. There has been the significant demutualisation activity within the marketplace, with its attendant actuarial issues, and more generally the Institute of Actuaries of Australia did institute a review of professional guidance in the last year or two and restructured the way that the guidance for the profession operates, and we really need to reconsider our guidance within that framework. So the Institute of Actuaries guidance structure is really in these three tiers: professional standard, practice guideline and information note. And the distinguishing features between them is that professional standards are typically involved where there's an actuarial role provided by legislation. Now, you could argue a few years ago we didn't really have that in health insurance. We certainly now have it with the appointed actuary regime under the Private Health Insurance Act. Compliance with professional standards is mandatory, and non-compliance with a professional standard is viewed as actionable conduct by the Institute with all its attendant disciplinary proceedings. The second area of guidance within the structure of practice guidelines are generally things that may not be provided by legislation, actuarial work that's not done under a specific piece of legislation, but there does need to be generally accepted actuarial practice developed to implement a practice guideline. And compliance with the practice guidelines, not mandatory, but non-compliance with a practice guideline should be disclosed. And information notes are more, as I said, the ones we've done on Medicare levy surcharge last year, they're more for something that's on a particular topical issue, or may have a short time horizon, something that needs to be put in place relatively quickly to provide information or to encourage discussion about a particular specific issue. So I think the first point in our review of these standards, and I suppose what we have in place, guidance notes, have been replaced effectively by practice guidelines, is have the merits of trying to elevate some of our professional standards, our guidance notes, to professional standards, or should they become practice guidelines. So that's something that Peter and I and the Health Practice Committee want to get some feedback today from you, that perhaps that's something you could be starting to think about. What are the relative merits of putting in place professional standards now that we have had accepted practice for a number of years, and we do now have those mandatory actuarial roles. So at this point I might pass over to Peter to consider where we might take our review of the standards.
Thanks, Andrew. Andrew is going so well and fluently, almost wanted to say to him he should just continue. But I think clearly listening to that, and I've been obviously involved in the discussions up until now, it does look like the practice has actually evolved to quite a great extent past where our professional guidance has actually left us. So please do think about these two things, and we would like some feedback on them. And we don't actually have a professional standard at the moment, and I'll quickly show you through what a framework the HPC has come up with, and then also briefly take you through what the process is that the Professional Standards Committee of the Institute of Actuaries has come up with, which is quite a I wouldn't use the word bureaucratic, but it's going along those lines. There's certain stages that need to be gone through. They need to be gone through in a particular sequence, and it's not really a process which would allow us to necessarily evolve our thinking. So it'd be good if we can actually get some feedback at this session. Right. So we haven't necessarily... We originally started off with about six different topics that we thought we needed some guidance on, and we then flipped back to just having one overall standard. By way of background, the Institute has actually tried to lead us a bit away from one massive standard because of the... they seem to be wanting to steer away from that in other practice areas. And I guess from a practical point of view, if something small changes, you don't want to have to go and troll through a 60 or 70 page document three or four times a year as changes develop. So what we've come up with as a structure at this point in time is effectively an ILVR, insurance liability valuation for health funds, as a primary standard, and that is actually taking the outstanding claims and adding in the future claims liability or the premiums liability, as whichever term you prefer, to expand the financial projections for health insurers to include the pricing round and the financial condition reports to effectively become a standard. So I think what we're saying there, the first and the third would be standards, and the middle one would be a guidance note. Is that right? Right, so the insurance liabilities valuation, as mentioned, it's the impact of 1023. I know we're all practicing in it. We've had a number of years now. I think we're into probably our third or fourth year of reporting under the standard. And we still don't have a lot in the literature about, or we don't have guidance on things like risk margins and the liability adequacy test. The inputs that we'd use there is the general insurance guidance on that, and then the other issue that's been pointed out, which we didn't touch on in our paper, which is coming up tomorrow on the LAT, is the fact that the actuarial liabilities do get a run in P2, and we would want something in our standard on that topic. Then on to the guidance note, which is on pricing and financial projections. Currently, it's actually quite interesting that because of what the Department of Health and Ageing did several years back and required actuarial certification of the rate review process, we effectively have got a standard, or we have got guidance on financial projections, which I think in the general insurance space landed up in the financial condition report side. So in effect, we've got some guidance on that matter, but we don't actually go into the other aspects about pricing of products, which is in relation to the actual pricing for the annual change, what to do about those parts of the Act which require... which are notifiable circumstances which require actuaries to form a view where a product has been changed, whether there needs to be an actuarial opinion and how deep that opinion should be, and of course the appointed actuary's oversight on new products that are being developed by health insurers. And the final piece that was one that I actually was quite tickled about, the fact that somehow FIACA's, as a regulator, managed to leapfrog the general insurance area and actually brought financial condition reports in to health insurance in Australia prior, I think one full year before the general insurance financial condition reports came in, and hence we've got a standard here, we've got a guidance here which needs to be converted into a standard, and it's a really reasonably good one, but I think one that we certainly would be leveraging off existing practice or guidance in life and general insurance areas. And we've had a number of rounds of feedback from the regulator about how they've viewed the financial condition reports that they've seen, and also to the extent that the Australian Government Actuary has got involved in them, and that's been useful input. The appointed actuary role needs to be covered off, and I think it would be entirely appropriate to reinforce what notifiable circumstance actually means. And it was quite interesting that recently the regulator did actually write the chairman of all health insurers in Australia, particularly on the topic of notifiable circumstance, and laid all eight of those items out. And I think there's even a catch-all after that, is that if there's something of financial significance, that should be that health insurers should be keeping their appointed actuaries informed on. How do we develop these standards? There's three stages. There's an exposure stage, there's a decision stage, and approval stage. It would go through the health practice committee to get the form of it. The institute would require the subcommittee that would work on the standards to appoint a peer reviewer, who would be somebody independent of the development process, but somebody experienced in the area. And we'd also need the approval of the Professional Standards Committee of the Institute of Actuaries. Having gone through a draft process, there would be a series of exposures to members, which would be formally through the Institute, through their process of informing members that a standard was coming, seeking comments, and there'd be a round, or maybe more than one round, of building those comments in and building the amendments in. It would then go to the decision stage, where the peer reviewer would become formally involved and scrutinise it again, and would be scrutinised by the Professional Standards Committee. And we've had a couple of discussions with the Professional Standards Committee, and they do take quite a rigorous and active role in this. So I think it's fair to say that any professional standard, guidance note, or information note that would actually get through would actually have been subject to quite a rigorous scrutiny. I would expect that at that stage, though, once it goes to council for approval, there shouldn't be much of a need to recycle. So how are we going to go about doing that? We'll obviously review the material that's currently there. We'd add new material as we got feedback, and some of that feedback might even be coming from this section. We would propose to actually circulate rough drafts within the group that are in this room and anyone who hasn't been able to attend today, and then we'd issue discussion drafts later, or timing-wise, issue discussion drafts by 30 June 2009 with attached explanatory memorandum, and we're looking for an effective date early in 2010. Hopefully, if we could have everything in place, Andrew might kick me for saying this, by 1 July 2010 is maybe more practical, but if we can get there before, that would be great. So we do need help with the process, and we have had offers of help already. We just haven't got ourselves well enough organised to tap those people on the shoulders, and we actually have got square tables with people that have been co-opted. The people who have been co-opted probably don't know about that yet, but it'd be interesting to see what comes up in terms of people who would feel that they've got a bit of time or some interest in assisting with the process. So please, if you can, get involved. As part of the timing thing is that once financial year end arrives, we've got outstanding claims valuations, FCRs and rate reviews in quick succession. The second half of the year does tend to go pretty quickly. If you don't get involved in the drafting process, please, when the discussion drafts come out, your feedback will be valuable. The extent to which we get good guidance, professional guidance for this evolving practice area is going to depend on, as I said, the people in the room. Go back on.
Perhaps, Peter, just to kickstart that process, we do have a rough draft that we can circulate now, and especially for those that's sitting there at the front of the room, especially for those that perhaps aren't familiar with the health insurance guidance that we've been talking about, the three guidance notes. This document is our first attempt to identify where the guidance notes need to be updated as a starting point. Obviously, there's still a lot of work to do before we get it to the stage that we are ready to send out a formal exposure draft to more generally to members of the profession. So we are looking for your feedback, and I suppose in particular, Stuart, on that first point about the merits of professional standards versus practice guidelines in these areas.
Yes. So do you want to take feedback? Who wants to speak handed out, or do you want to take discussion on this?
I think perhaps discussion on this, because the
okay. So in a two-stage process, maybe first of all comments on what's been said so far. That bit could be quite easy. I want to ask a Dorothy Dix question, because there's a certain amount of downside in having something which is absolutely compulsory. Failure to live with it, or failure to follow it, is prima facie actionable conduct. And so I'd like to be clear about what the benefits of putting that in place are. And I asked Andrew that last week after we'd met up with the Professional Standards Committee, so I'll ask you again today and maybe you can answer that. Just if people don't think these benefits are good enough, then now is the moment to say so, because there won't be another moment like this.
Well, it's good that John's actually at the back, because we might ask him to express a view on this as well, but from the Institute's point of view. But it does seem to us that for a practice area not to have any professional standards at all would seem to be a second best solution. It would seem that given the statutory role that we do have as appointed actuaries, that if we can't back that up, our standards of actuarial practice, with an enforceable enforceable professional standard, then it would seem that, you know, it's a second best solution, that we really should be able to mandate some minimum standards of behaviour that clients can expect from health insurance appointed actuaries. And I know that the Institute more generally has been trying to tighten up its guidance to make them more enforceable in the wake of certain events where they were found to be wanting, I think, and that it was very easy to avoid having to comply with standards that don't use strong language like must, but instead use words like should and may. So I think more generally across the profession there is a movement towards professional standards rather than away from them. We haven't had one in health insurance yet. Some of the reasons we talked about earlier, that we didn't have the legislative role. We perhaps were an emerging area where we didn't necessarily have long-standing accepted actuarial practice. I think both of those reasons are less and less relevant now. Of course, there is the attendant downside. I think it is described perhaps on the first page here. There's a mandatory section that needs to be included in all professional standards, and it's that paragraph 1.3 that talks about this very issue that it is binding on members of the Institute, and non-compliance is actionable conduct. And so I think, you know, obviously this is the downside, that if we put something in place, if we find that if we don't all agree that is the standard we have to be held to account to, then I think this is the debate we need to have now.
Just a quick question.
Hang on, grab the mic there.
Well, beautiful assistant. One of the key distinctions between a guidance note and a standard, so the guidance note, you cannot comply so long as you tell the client that you're not.
Yes.
Is there a layout of that kind in the professional standard?
No.
So you, even whether the client wants it or not, you've got to do it. I've seen that problem arise where it's been a pain for both parties in the investment area, for example, where the Institute mandated some years ago some way in which investment advisors had to act. And there are actuaries involved in giving investment advice to clients such as banks who did not want to go through all that rigmarole, and it caused the problem. So that is the downside that I've actually seen in practice. We've got to do something that neither you nor the client wants you to do.
So I think this is the kind of thing that has been we have been discussing ourselves, that in one sense a professional standard can only ever set out minimum standards of behaviour. It can't set out best practice, whereas the guidance note can set out best practice, and I think that's what we've viewed our guidance note as, trying to push people towards minimum standards as well as explaining beyond that best practice. But the professional standard really has to be that minimum set that we can all agree is a sensible minimum to overcome the issue you say. I mean, we shouldn't have things in a professional standard that
that could be disposed.
Yes, or that will lead to the problem you describe, because that would obviously be a poor outcome. But then I can't see any other way than they would need to be minimum standards. But however, they cannot be supplemented by a guidance note. The requirements have to be contained within that one document. The Institute's quite clear on this. The professional standard can't be supplemented by something that, you know, is incorporated from a practice guideline, for the simple reason that, you know, it is the legal minimum and it needs to be there clearly in the one document.
David,
what's your name? I applaud what's going on here, but I implore you to use the word private health insurer throughout. Legislation calls the organisations private health insurer, and I think the name right through all of the documentation should follow that. I want to take up in part the point that Peter just made about these three documents. And so we've got two of them here proposed as standards, and one of them is guidance, and Peter's put some very good points about being tied into a straitjacket. Can I ask to what extent the decision to put the second document as a guidance rather than a standard is in part due to the fact that financial projections around rating are very heavily flavoured by what comes out of Canberra in terms of the specifications? And if you write it in a standard, we end up in an awful pickle, because Canberra says move left and the standard says move right. And there are one or two people from the Department of Health in the room.
I actually think the distinction was more about the formal legislative requirement rather than the issues you mentioned, David. I mean, the first one about outstanding claims is, we've got AASB 1023, it's more and more the requirements are for actuaries to certify outstanding claims provisions, financial condition reports similarly. The rate review process, I think, Peter, it's expressed as an opinion rather than a certification. And
you have to move the... I noticed there was a change in wording. It started off with being a certificate. It's now actually an opinion that actuaries are giving. And I guess when it comes to pricing, there's the considerations of
market conditions and everyone being different, it would be quite hard to make a standard out of pricing and forecasting where you're saying must. And I think this really goes to the heart of, and I'm not sure that what Peter Carroll was talking about, whether you can get around that by distinguishing your advice as being professional advice as opposed to actuarial advice, and whether, because the Institute of Actuaries as actuaries does allow us to distinguish when we're giving advice whether it's actually statutory actuarial advice and whether it's actually professional advice. And if there's no statutory role in the investment area for the actuary, the actuary might well be able to do what the client wants and what he feels comfortable with. But we are talking about, in relation to the standards, I think what Andrew's really said is those are the bits which are actually enshrined in the legislation. In the case of the PS 650 or the proposed PS 650, that is supported by the accounting standard. And what comes out of the Department of Health for the premium round does change from year to year. It would be quite hard to actually try and make that rigorous. I can't come up with a better explanation than that. David doesn't look convinced or at all happy.
Carl Lehman. I just want to make a comment about the financial condition report and the guidance note that currently in the insurer obligation laws, that's a requirement of appointed actuaries and they must comply with that guidance note in particular. So there is somewhat of a requirement there from a regulatory perspective. But from that perspective, again, you've got the regulator saying that you must comply with it and the Institute of Standards saying that you may comply with it. Just more a comment on the current legislation.
Yeah, that's probably a function of where we've come from rather than inventing that regime if we had a clean sheet of paper. And yes, there is an issue with the reference that's in the Act that would need to be updated if and when we update this guidance.
Has FIAC expressed a view?
Not. We've had informal discussion with Paul Greenwood, but we haven't asked them to express a view. So the task, it seems to me, is to firstly accept that we've progressed far enough that there is now, in some areas, a minimum set of practice which we would all expect everyone else in this room to follow in certain circumstances. That's step one. And then step two, having accepted step one, is to be really clear about what is that minimum set of practice and get it written out so that in that situation, these steps are compulsory, and in all the other situations we find ourselves in, we fall back on guidance, not really compulsory professional standard. And having asked Andrew that question, what's the benefit of it, I thought it is a good answer to say, if we're the only practice area in the profession with a statutory role and no professional standard, we're perhaps being a bit economical with the discipline. What was that?
Yeah, David Torrance. I suppose I come from the, rightly or wrongly, I come from the sort of standing that I think the Institute's made a real rod for its back with professional standards and the fact that it is a must. And I think we're going to find it, it's going to be a very broad standard if it says we must do something. I just think we paint ourselves into a bit of a corner with that. And I would much prefer to see three guidance notes or professional guidance actually rather than the standards. I just think that there's, I accept the point about legislative and all that sort of thing, but I think the Institute's gone down totally the wrong track with their musts in the standard. I just think that's been the wrong way to go, and I think we just need to think long and hard how we deal with that.
Stuart, just on that point, then if that's what we decided to do, then that rules out professional standards for us because we can't write a professional standard that has the words may in it. So accepting that.
I think if I'm correct, maybe the professional standard is a must. It's not a may. Yeah. Or whereas in the draft here at the moment, you've got shoulds in there.
That's which have to go.
Yeah. Now, my view is if it is a must, then you can still write a professional standard. But it becomes, you know,
be called a practice guideline.
Well, you could do a standard and it's a must, but it has to be a very low level one because you've got to allow for, you know, the absolute, you know, sort of discretion that lots of actuaries are going to bring in, whereas the guidance note or professional guidance just gives you a lot more discretion. I just think that must creates a lot of problems.
Nolene Wolfe, just an observation from, I suppose, being familiar with the general insurance professional standards is I would disagree with your point there in that I think it all depends on the way in which the standard is worded and the words must consider, you know, can be used rather than should, you know, take this approach versus another approach. And I think that, you know, we do have an obligation as a profession to make sure that there's a minimum standard there in terms of what we consider. And if we haven't considered it, to state the reasons why we haven't done so.
At this stage, John, unless someone else wants to talk about this, can you just make a comment about, do we have a choice on this? Say your name.
John Moroney, but do I have a choice about this?
You don't have a choice. You must comment on whether we have a choice about it.
The move to having professional standards that are mandatory and based around the concepts of members must do things rather than should precedes my taking on this role. So from memory, it was brought in the first half of 2006 and it really did flow from discussion in the years before that, particularly post the HIH Royal Commission, where there was a real push to put more teeth into standards so that there was a stronger basis that says the minimum levels is all members doing particular roles, particularly things defined under legislation or otherwise regarded as very serious, sort of did go beyond guidance and became obligatory. That debate, I'm sure, is never dead, and if people do have views on that, they shouldn't just say, well, we won't do anything about them, but it's not the forum to talk about them in a particular area, particular standard. It's really the overall approach. So if there was a view that we needed to be doing things differently with the whole structure of professional standards and guidance, then talk to your councils about it. They're the one charged with the overall basis on which that part of the professional infrastructure is developed and maintained. Probably one or two of the existing councillors were there when it was brought in, so you've got a fresh set of minds around the council table now looking at these issues. I'm not at all flagging they would be likely to change them, but there will be a big thrust over the next few years to re-look at regulation. I think it's more likely to get tougher overall than weaker, given the push is coming, so the question's a live one, but I wouldn't be expecting to see any move away from professional standards having must at least until we complete the first iteration of putting the first set in place, and then potentially identifying, well, what are the problems with that, and hopefully that'll come out more in a theoretical analysis rather than actuaries being dragged before disciplinary hearings because they didn't do something that they were required to and they didn't do it for a good reason, and then you get caught in that difficult situation of, you know, what does the actuary do that really feels the only way to express their professional judgment is to breach a professional standard, and that's a very difficult situation to be in. So that's my read of where we are currently.
I think that means it's not compulsory for the area to have a professional standard, but I think it means you still think they're good ideas. It's a good idea. Well, I think that's
just adding a dead end. I think it would look odd if in 3 years' time we had professional standards in all the areas where there's statutory responsibilities except private health insurance.
Yeah. And I agree with that, actually. When I got involved with health, the people who really knew what they were doing could still sit in the front two rows here. Now there's a whole room full of people who know what they're doing. It's getting bigger and bigger. And to some extent, this is about us setting up what we absolutely expect of each other. What's the minimum standard we expect of each other? Because the really informal network is getting too big to operate as a fully informal network.
Thank you.
If I can maybe make a comment about professional standards, my memory goes back maybe a little bit earlier than John's. There was some requirement if the Institute of Actuaries wanted to be recognised as a profession in Australia under professional law, the requirement was to have professional standards. Now, possibly the Institute gets recognised as a profession by having existing professional standards in other practice areas, but I do think I'd have to agree with John that we probably do need a professional standard for private health insurance, and maybe the form of that standard is going... And maybe this is why, in my impression, we're getting a bit of pushback from the Professional Standards Committee about what we actually put into the professional standard, whether they... I think they're more or less saying to us, think very carefully before you create a professional standard. And I know that some of the reports that we do currently in the general insurance space, we do say that we've complied with the standard with the following exceptions. Maybe we won't be able to do that in future. And mainly the reasons that you don't comply with the standard is that the scope that you've been given by your client is... it excludes those items, or alternatively the organisation is such that budgetary considerations doesn't allow you to go and do a detailed expense analysis every time you do a valuation for a small health insurer, private health insurer. So you've got those sorts of considerations, and all private health insurers need an appointed actuary, and if we create a Rolls-Royce version of the actuarial advice, it's going to turn some of those private health insurers off from getting, or you get that conflict that Peter Carroll referred to.
In the
screen
that you're making, are there other things you want to come out?
Yeah. Well, I think that's been a very useful discussion, and it might mean that we have to come up with a different structure that enables us to put out perhaps a very small professional standard that has the minimum benchmarks, but doesn't jettison all the good work that's already been put into the guidance notes in terms of trying to express perhaps better practice or best practice.
Can I do a quick, really informal poll? We've got three things in front of us that Peter and Andrew have drafted. They've said we should have a professional standard for calculation of liabilities or valuation of liabilities, professional guidance for projections, and professional standard for FCR. So could I have a show of hands for people who think it would be wrong to do a professional standard for valuation of liabilities?
Can we have an empty pants
vote? I thought I'd just get a bit of a sense of...
I mean, I take the point.
Before any other discussion, Peter,
let's just get this clear. It depends on the wording. It's absolutely fundamental.
Yeah.
And it's the point that was made by Naomi. And I mean, I can live with a professional standard. If it doesn't make me do things, my client doesn't work.
It does. And that's the point of it.
That, yeah,
it's
you,
a mandatory part.
Yeah.
Yes, I know.
So we're taking... Peter, just bear with me for 30 seconds. This will take 30 seconds, and I'm going to just talk louder than you.
You've got the microphone.
No, it's not force it, because the choice is between something narrow with a minimum standard you have to do, or something broader with good advice, that's good practice, which you can... To the extent
of climate watch. So I'll define my terms. The professional standard is narrow and compulsory. Professional guidance is wide and broad, and you don't have to, if that makes sense. So would it be wrong to have professional standard in the area of liability calculation? How, hands up. It would be wrong to have a professional standard.
This isn't working.
You wouldn't like it.
People who voted previously.
You need another category, and maybe.
Okay. Let's move. No, I'm not going to. This isn't working, is it? Yeah. This is the way the Health Practice Committee is heading. If you think you need to have a say in this, then you really need to get onto Andrew and Peter and tell them what you think they need to be doing. Brent, you want? We've just opened our doors, so you've got 1 minute.
We had a lot of discussion about this at the large cost practice going to be and there are certainly two sides to the argument, you know, here, the professional standard and the guidance, so, and it'd be nice to have both. But, you know, I think it's clear that you can't have both. But there would be nothing wrong with producing the paper as a result of going through this exercise that says, you know, the paper includes the draft professional standard and then includes what would have been the guidance note, had we written the guidance note. And then we can all refer to the paper. You get the point? You can have your paper needed then too.
Yeah.
Because we will have written down in the paper what would have been in the guidance note, had we written the guidance note.
Yeah. And I think that's the major point we've been grappling with,
yeah,
is to say what we've been trying to do to date is to encourage people who are coming into the health insurance area to learn and develop and push towards, well, best practice, but to emerging practice. Yet we're now confronted with a regime that, if we want to move to professional standards for all the reasons we've talked about, is actually going to force us to only include the things we can all collectively agree on as a minimum. So I fundamentally agree with the approach, and that may well be where we head. But perhaps just to conclude by saying that this is just the very first start of this. Of course, there's the process, the engagement process, exposure draft process that Peter explained as part of the Institute's process. So we'll, I'm sure, be reconvening on this topic later on this year.
And a final word from Peter.
I think rather than doing that paper, Brent, we actually need the textbook on private health insurance, and I would like to think that you might be a potential author for that.
Okay, so on that note, everybody, if I could say thank you to Andrew and Peter for the work they've done so far. And for